Sandra, we've mentioned that in California and here and at other times and places that we wanted so very much to hear again your story, your Baba story of how you came to Baba and what coming to Baba has brought to your life and what it has meant to you and what it means to you. And we'd really appreciate it very much if you could, even though this is not quite as natural as the first time you told us, because it came so naturally then. But we would like very much to have this in our archives, I suppose you'd say, our personal archives. And so maybe you could begin by telling us the beginning.
Well, the beginning is back in Newfoundland. And I was brought up in a little Irish fishing village in St. John's. And my mother was the town prostitute. She was a very lovely lady and a very warm woman. And my father was a man who flew in and out of our lives constantly. He was not with us for any long period of time ever. And when he left, mother, who could not read or write, went on the streets as a way of taking care of us. There were four of us, five, and one sister who died when she was a little girl. So I was, as a young child, always in the company of a friend, I called him. Now, the friend looked nothing like Jesus, and so I didn't associate this person as being God. But as a little girl, I can remember any time that I was really in desperate trouble, I'd always go to church, and always this image of somebody would come into my mind that left me feeling like, although God didn't answer my prayers, this person did. He was a great source of comfort. And so that was my early life. It was filled with God. I wanted to be with the nuns. I wanted to be with the priests. I didn't want to be away from the church. I used to go to the graveyard for some strange reason. I always felt close rapport with whatever the feeling was at the graveyards, and used to close my eyes, and I was certain that as soon as I opened my eyes, there was going to be a cloud come down from heaven, and God was going to be on the cloud, and he was going to take me away from this earth. And I waited and waited and waited, just to close my eyes and say, okay, I'm going to count to three. And I'd wake up and I'd say, no, I'm going to close my eyes and I'll count to three again, then he'll be there. So that's how I lived my life. I was absolutely in love with the nuns and the priests, absolutely in love, and they really saved my life when I was a child. And then when I was almost 16, my mom, who, as I said, was a prostitute, and it figures very heavily into the story, had allowed me to work as a waitress in a local pub and after schools and on the weekends. And my very best friend, Carol Ann, and I worked there. And we were very good girls. You know, we didn't mess around or anything. We were very much above reproach in that way. We were coming out of the restaurant, the pub. It was really late at night, and we'd locked up. And some Americans from the American base were driving up and down the street. And we'd always been told to stay away from them because the local girls were just really prey. And we were taken aback when this car pulled up in front of us and stopped, and before we could do anything about it, we were dragged into the car. And we were taken to a fishing shack many, many miles from the city, and we were held for almost 2 weeks. And we were raped repeatedly. And Carol Ann ended up committing suicide. When we finally made our way back to town, we went to the church, and we told the priest what had happened. And here was this priest who I'd loved all my life, and the nuns, and yet instead of believing me, brought to mind the fact that my mother was a prostitute. And because my mom was a prostitute, he couldn't believe that I'd really been raped. And it was the old like mother, like daughter routine. Well, Carol and I left the church absolutely humiliated. And nobody had even bothered looking. Another thing about my mother's life was that she was gone more than she was around, and I was at an age when I was pretty well left to my own devices. So the one thing that the priest did say to me, though, before he left was, if I were you, I'd get away from here. There's really no life for you. And that was the best advice I'd ever heard at that time in my life. And in talking to my friend again, in my heart to my friend, it seemed to be the thing to do. And so I had the opportunity to come to America as a servant. And I left the island and came as a servant to the same American bases. The commanders, when they were transferred, used to take local girls with them for very cheap wages and bring them to America. When I got here, I found out I was pregnant. That really frightened me. And this commander was stationed in Rhode Island and was very kind to me, but in about my 7th month of pregnancy, I had a complete nervous breakdown. I was totally alone in America, and except for this friend, and they thought I was crazy for talking to him, I didn't have anybody, and so they committed me to a mental hospital in Rhode Island. And the mental hospital was called Charles B. Chapin Hospital, and it was near Providence, and that's where my little girl was born. And they took her away from me right away. And I'll never forget this one time. I was in this room, and I was really deep in thought, rationalizing the whole thing. I mean, it seemed like I was supposed to be there for some reason, and it was okay, and I had a lot I could give the people in there, I felt. And I was really strong. And we were herded down the hall like cattle to the bathtubs. It was like they put a strap around each of the women, and we walked down the aisles together in a group to the bathtubs. And then you were sat in the tubs, and then the tubs had straps across the sides and across the length of them, so you couldn't try to drown yourself, I guess it was. But I remember walking by, and you had to walk past the padded cells, the famous padded cells, and there was this woman hanging onto some very short bars in a window kind of thing, really screaming, really crying. And I reached in to comfort her. I just stopped and reached in to comfort her, and she bit my finger. I mean, I passed out from the pain. She couldn't let go of my finger. Her teeth were attached to it. So it was that kind of an environment. It was a very frightening kind of experience. And I had 32 shock treatments, all because of severe, they called it mental depression over the pregnancy, and also because they thought I was crazy because I talked to somebody that wasn't there. But that somebody that wasn't there was my strength. It was really my strength. In the meantime, interestingly enough, my father had come back into my mother's life. And they had decided that Newfoundland was taboo. I mean, her life was so awful there that they were going to make a new start. And my mother's sister had married an American serviceman who was stationed in San Antonio, Texas. So they were going to come to America, this land of great opportunity, and they were going to make a new start. They were absolutely convinced that everything they'd ever saw on television about America was true. And all they had to do was come here, and they were going to have all these wealth and riches and everything. So when my daughter was born in the hospital, my mother came by Greyhound bus to Rhode Island, and they took her and brought her back to San Antonio. So, and they planned to raise her. They didn't care what happened to me. They were just interested in taking the baby. And people tell me that my mother was saying, look what my daughter has done to me. See this cross I have to bear, so with the child. So anyway, I got out of the hospital and had nothing to do, and so I started going to libraries and studying. I'd get books on science, I didn't know why, and I'd sit for hours in libraries and start studying, and got jobs in various places across the country, and finally studied on my own so much that I was accepted into this program that was only for degreed people, but I'd taken the test and it passed so well that nobody knew the difference. They thought I had degrees. I said I did, but I hadn't really. And it got me into a program where I got some really good training as a medical technologist and worked in a hospital. It was there that I met my husband, and he taught me so many things, my former husband. He was from a very wealthy family in Indiana, and he had been used to gracious living and this little fisherman's daughter got a taste of that, and I took to it like a duck to water. It was like I knew about these things. I knew how to set the tables, and I knew what was expected, and it was really like a drought, and I was saying, okay, teach me quick, I've got other things to do in my life, teach me quick. And he did, and at the same time, we got word that my mother had turned to alcohol. My daughter was now 6 years old, and I told John all about my daughter, and he said I could go to Texas and get her. So I went and got my own child and brought her home to live with me. She always thought of me as her sister. And we also had an 11-month-old son of our own at that time. Then I started to get really sick, and I went to the doctor, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong, but I was losing weight really fast, and my blood was very anemic. And I got frightened by that. It was like almost as if I went to the doctor enough to be diagnosed, it would be all over. That I couldn't take the diagnosis right now. I had other things I had to do. And in 1970, when I was pregnant with the baby, John left for good. He was a military major in the Army, and he had volunteered several times for Vietnam, and now was interested in being the youngest general in the Army and had absolutely no time for the family. And so he left. When I went in to have a checkup on the pregnancy, I started convulsing. I was 3 months pregnant. It was then they decided something was very seriously wrong. And for the next 4 months, I was in medicines and checked and biopsies done. When I was 7 months pregnant, they told me I had Hodgkin's disease. And it was strain something or other, but it was a 2A form, and it was very serious. And they told me that they couldn't start chemotherapy till the baby was born. That night I went into labor. I was almost 7 months pregnant. And they tried everything they could. It was Baba's grace that doctor was incredible. He's never left my side for the 2 days that I was in labor. When the baby was born, the baby was 2.5 pounds. And they said if he lives 24 hours, he's got a chance. And the doctor never left his side for the 24 hours, had the cot by the bed. And all this time, I was fine. I mean, I was told that everything was going to be okay. There was no question in my mind the baby was going to be okay. I gave the doctor strength. Don't worry about it. He's going to be just fine. And they couldn't believe it, that I could be so calm when the child was fighting for his life. But they also told me that now it was time to start chemotherapy treatments. And I was scared about that. It really frightened me. And I knew I had a responsibility to do everything I could to take care of myself, but I was frightened. And I started reading books. I started wondering what death was like, reading books on reincarnation. And that's when I came across Baba. And all of a sudden, everything made sense to me. Now, interestingly enough, nothing I read about Baba showed a picture of him as a young man. There was nothing that showed, you know, Listen Humanity, I think it was, and then the Seven Realities, and it was a pamphlet, but no pictures. And I savored that pamphlet, and I savored beams, and I read it all the time, never knowing that there was any such thing as, quote, say, Baba lover, but simply finding this book and recognizing that that's the truth that has sustained me all my life. I moved to San Antonio with the children because, as I said, my ex-husband was in the military and all of this stuff had happened at his latest installation before he went overseas again. And I moved to San Antonio where at least, even though my mother was an alcoholic, there was some family around. And I needed to be there, I felt, and I had a job offer and from some people who knew me in the military and knew my medical technology background. And so in San Antonio, I bought a little house in the suburbs and attempted to take care of the children, never knowing what the next day was going to bring, but not really convinced that I was ready to die. And I met a man who had dark hair, you know, really full, a big dark mustache, incredible eyebrows, and deep-set brown eyes. And I was so attracted to him, I can't tell you. It was unbelievable. I was so attracted to him. And he worked at it for a free clinic. And I was doing some volunteer work there. And one night he invited me over to his apartment for dinner. We'd become very good friends, and over a period of time it looked as if he really wanted to get romantically involved with me. And I looked on his bookshelf, and there was Beans. And I said, "Do you know about Meher Baba?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "I don't believe it. Is there anyone else around here that knows about Meher Baba?" He said, "I don't think so." He said, "This guy comes out from California to do drug workshops for the Air Force, named Alan Cohen. And he gave me this book a couple of years ago. It was just sitting there in his bookshelf. And this guy's name was Al Carlosi, A.C. They were the same age, Alan Cohen and he. They were born the same day and the same initials. And we, as soon as Al told me that there were Baba lovers in California and that he had gotten this book from a man named A.C., our relationship got rocky. And I still continued my volunteer work at the free clinic, but we were no longer interested in each other in terms of romantically interested. Then one day he said, "By the way, that man I told you about, Alan Cohen, is coming to town. He's going to do a workshop for the free clinic." And I said, "He is wonderful." Now, it's still, I was glad he was coming, but I still wasn't interested in finding out about Baba from him. There seemed to be something holding me back from that. The day we got to the airport to meet him, there was this young girl standing there at the gate. And I looked over and here was this picture, an older picture, a picture of Meher Baba, the one picture that I recognized. And she was just standing there and I went up and I said, "Excuse me, I mean, I'm really puzzled now. Do you know about Meher Baba too?" She said, "Well, of course I know. Do you know about Baba?" And I said, "Yes." And that's when I heard my first Jai Baba. Said, "Jai Baba," and threw her arms around me. And I said, "Oh my goodness, what's your name?" And she said, "Marilyn McGivney." And I said, "Oh, my name is Sandra Nylander. Where do you live?" And she told me her address, and it was around the corner from my house. We were the same age. We were both single. When Alan got off the plane, it could have been from the man in the moon for all I cared. All I was interested in is she was there to meet him, and I wanted him very much to get back on the plane and go back where he came from so that I could have her attention. She came to my house after he left in a couple of days, and we were inseparable from that point on. She brought over books to me, and she said, "Sam, how did she hear about Bob?" And I said, "Well, I read books about him." And I said, "Also, I was drawn to him by Khalil Gibran. But I said, also, it seems to me that the things that this friend, this image," and I said, "I might have just conjured him up because I needed some comfort." And I described him, and I said, "You know, he reminds me a lot of Al Carlosi, you know, flowing hair and the dark mustache." And I said, "And this verse of Khalil Gibran just keeps running through my mind, running through my mind." And she didn't think anything more about it, but then the next week she was at an antique book sale in San Antonio. And she looked down on this book table in San Antonio, and she saw a little blue book called Silent Revelations of Meher Baba. She said, "What is a book on Baba doing here?" And she picked it up and opened it up. And there was the picture I described, and there was the verse by Khalil Gibran. And she brought it home to me. She said, "I don't believe this, but look." That was my introduction to Baba as being the friend that has sustained me all my life. That's when I knew it was him. And I said, "Marilyn, I've got to get to India. I have got to go to India." And she said, "Well, it's, you know, if it's Baba's timing, you know, whenever it's right, it will be Baba's timing." And by that time, I had this idea that my time was short. I was having difficulty breathing, and I was getting tired very quickly all the time. And I had an intuition that, you know, maybe my time really wasn't going to be long. So, sure enough, the following January, I was able to get the money to go. And it was a year of really incredible circumstances where I don't know how in the world I managed to get that money, but it was right there. I started planning for the trip and all of a sudden, you know, the money was there. And it was my drive, it was a drive to get to India. And Marilyn told me so much about Peg Andy and about meeting you and how much she loved you both, that the thought of meeting you on my way to India really was very strong in my mind. And so I stopped here and got to spend some beautiful hours with you at the airport on my way to India.
Yes.
Now, the story got, when I got to India, and I was really weak and really tired, and we had prepared this program for Baba. I met Ann Giles in India and Ellis Pines in India, and they had said, let's try to sing something for Baba at the tomb. And so we'd worked up this little program, and we were going to do it the day that I left India. So that morning, it was the morning that the women Mandali were coming. That was the day we were going to do it. Now, the day before this, I felt like a doubting Thomas. And the day before, I decided to deny Baba. And I don't know what it was, but I was at Baba's house in Maharasad, and Mara had put me in the room and left me alone. And I was sitting on the floor, and I decided to question him as God. I decided that I was really going to challenge him. And I picked up the sandals, which were on the little nightstand next to the bed. And all of a sudden, my Catholic upbringing, oh my God, I've touched something that belongs to God. It's a sacrilege. Right away, I felt really repentant, you know, that I touched something of his. And I then, though, picked up the sandals again and put them at my face, and I said, if you're really God, why didn't you stay and let me put my head at your feet? Why didn't you stay? Well, the bell rang, and it was time to leave, and I was running down the porch steps, and Mani called me, and she said, Sandra, please don't go. Mara wants to see you. Now, what I'd said was all in my mind. And I went to see her, and she said, I want you to have this. It's from Baba. And I said, what is it? And she said, it's water that was used to wash his feet. So keep it with you always. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I just touched his sandals and wanted to put my head at his feet, and here came this water. So I took the water with me, and I was speechless. The next morning, I went to the tomb, and I said, that water is nothing. I mean, it's just water. Why couldn't you let me see you? When I walked with my friend and he held my hand, why couldn't you just wait it around so I really could do it? And I heard this voice bellowing out and said, Sandra, are you in the tomb? Said, yes, yes. I walked outside. Mansari wants to see you. And I went over to see Mansari, and she took me in a little corner of the kitchen, and she said, here are some fingernail clippings from Baba's hands. She said, please keep them with you always. I could not believe that. It was my heart's desire again. But that wasn't enough. And the next morning was the morning of the program. And I was in the tomb and I was singing my heart out to Baba, and the picture, the mural of Baba with the child in the red scarf, his face went from the old Baba to the young Baba that I had seen as a child to the old Baba. And I sat back on my heels in the tomb and just prayed to him, Baba, let me know you're God. If you're really God, Mara's going to take a rose from that tomb and give it to me. I really didn't want to believe it, I guess, or something. I don't know. But I never expected that to materialize. And Mara got up from the other side of the tomb, and she walked around to the front of it and knelt down. And she reached out and picked a rose up from the center of the tomb, and she took it to her heart. And then she put it to her mouth, and then she handed it to me like that, and she said, Eve, it's from Baba. Well, I sat back on my heels and dissolved into tears. And I felt cured, I felt purified, I felt well and new, kind of. And 2 hours later, Gohair came and got me. She said it had been 2 hours. And they took me to Vilu's, where the women Mandali had lunch with me before I came on the train to come home. Then I got home. It was really quite an experience. I couldn't talk about it for a long time. And I just really got Mara's permission to mention the water, because she had asked me not to say anything to anybody, and I told her about maybe a couple of talks that were private, you know, for the archives, and she said that was okay, but it was a personal thing. So I haven't really spoken about it, you know, and anyway, I got back to San Antonio, and from that point on, I became weaker all the time. My stomach was distended out to, I looked very pregnant, my face was very swollen, and my arms, and I knew, I put the house up for sale right away, and the children's father had been reassigned to the States, and I sent them off to see him, and I knew that it was the end of the line, and Marilyn knew it too. We were inseparable, and she was going through this with me. And the only thing I could ask God is she'd become very attached to me. And I said to Baba, you know, if I die, it's going to crush her. I mean, I know she has you, but she's never had a friendship like this before, and it's going to destroy her, and you have to give her strength. So the night I really got ill, I called her. I said, Mara, I think it's time for you to take me to the hospital. She said, all right, and she came over. And we went into a room I had called the sunroom, and it was immediately filled with light. It was a very soft but a bright light. And I spoke, and Marilyn said I went on for a long time with passages that she recognized as hearing some of it from Anayat Khan. We still haven't located all of it, but one of the passages we have located, and it was in the 12th volume of Anayat Khan. I don't know where it came from, but it really was to tell her to let me go, that if she held on to me, I couldn't leave my body. The agony, her suffering was going to hold me to my body, and I had other things I had to do. So she got me to the emergency room, and as soon as she got me to the hospital, inside the hospital, I passed out. And the next thing, I was in intensive care. And Marilyn was in the room, and they had called Alan, and the prayer group started in Chicago and in California. And I had this heart machine hooked up and oxygen, the whole works. And I had my head to the side, and I was looking at the heart monitor, and all of a sudden, the line was straight across, the heart monitor. And I said, the line is straight, I'm thinking to myself. That means my heart is stopped. And I thought, that means I'm dead. And I was thinking this, and yet the monitor went off, and all of a sudden this nurse was over, turning me back on my back, pounding on my chest, picking up the phone and calling something into the receiver. And all of a sudden there I was, standing at the edge of the bed, down at the foot of the bed, looking down at my body. And I said, this is interesting. That's me down there, but here I am up here. And I wanted to touch the nurse and say, hey, I'm not down there. I'm right up here, watching. And all of a sudden, this team of people, and I'm assuming they were doctors and nurses, pushing a green machine, came running toward my bed, fast. And as soon as they came through those swinging doors into that unit, it scared me so much that I didn't want to stay around and play with them anymore. You know, I wanted to get out of there. And as soon as I turned, I made a conscious effort to turn. Now, it wasn't like I was just this shell of something. I mean, I firmly believe that if I pinched myself, I would have felt it. I mean, I had consciousness standing over that bed. And I made that turn, and as soon as I did, I went into this vacuum. And it was moving. It was definitely a sided thing. And it was grayish black. And it moved me very quickly upward. And I was headed toward that same light that I'd seen in my house.